Case up today is United States versus Wilder. Are counsel ready to proceed? Okay. Appellant's counsel.
Chief Judge Erdman, members of the court, good morning. May it please the court, my name is Captain Bree Ermentrout, and I represent the appellant, Lance Corporal Carlton Wilder. Chief Judge Erdman, with your permission, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Granted.
Thank you. RCM 707 did not abrogate the substantial information rule of U.S. v. Johnson. This court has never held that, and both the Army and Coast Guard have affirmed the validity of Johnson and the substantial information rule. In this case, the government had substantial information on November 13, 2012, when appellant confessed. Although the original preferral date was December 4th, additional charges were preferred relating to the same confessed events in April and July, resulting in appellant's pretrial confinement for almost 9 months from November until his arraignment on these additional charges in August, for a total of 364 days of pretrial confinement until the trial date of November 12, 2013. The plain reading of RCM 707 that the government urges creates an absurdity. The Air Force and Bray said such a reading of RCM 707 is too narrow and would emasculate the speedy trial provisions of RCM 707. The prosecution would have no incentive to promptly charge an accused with any offenses other than the minimum necessary for him to be confined. While this government points to two cases, an Air Force case and an Army, as precedent for the lower court's opinion, neither of them are persuasive. The Army's Robbins case and the Air Force Proctor case both involved two separate unrelated investigations where misconduct was discovered later in time. That is not this case.
But your initial argument is the substantial information rule applies to RCM 707.
Correct.
Is that correct? Okay. And how do you get to that position?
Because the Johnson rule, the substantial information rule set forth in Johnson has never been overturned.
But the rule was designed to implement Article 10 well before the introduction of RCM 707. And it seems there's an argument, at least, that these two provisions can act independently of one another. So whether or not the substantial information rule does or does not continue to apply to Article 10 is a different question. But I think the harder question is that has it ever applied to RCM 707, which has pretty clear statutory or language provisions?
Yes, Your Honor. The two are distinct but complementary provisions, and it is clear that under 707 there is a time frame. But it should be read together with the substantial information rule, which has never been overturned, even though the Cosman Court said that the 90-day presumption test of U.S. v. Burton was overturned. It never said that the substantial information rule was overturned.
Has it ever said that it applies, the substantial information applies to 707? Have we ever said that?
No, sir.
Have we ever, since Cosman, applied the substantial information test?
No, but it, Your Honor, but then again, the facts in this case are somewhat unusual and may not have been seen before. Here you have an instance where the accused confessed to his conduct on November 13th. Yet, the government waited until 126 days later, until March 18th, before they interviewed the witness whom appellant had already given them. That's 126 days of pretrial confinement.
Well, that maybe begs the question as to whether or not the government acted with reasonable diligence, but what does substantial information have to do at all with that analysis?
Well, in the Proctor and case, which the Air Force, which the government relies on, it's a totally different scenario where there are different investigations, different charges. Here, everything was laid out on one night, and it was all one pattern. It was really similar to the Air Force case in Bray, where the charges were inextricably intertwined. So substantial information has to be, in this case, shows that the government had substantial information on that night when the appellant confessed to his conduct. He gave the government information. He gave them everything they needed. However, the government still waited. They waited 126 days to interview a known witness. They waited 265 days to arraign the appellant on the additional charges. And the total was 364 days of pretrial confinement. Now, what that does, Your Honor, that leaves an accused to languish in pretrial confinement while the government has the opportunity to perfect its case. And in fact, you have an ambiguity with RCM 707. It doesn't address what happens when the accused is already in confinement, and then there are additional charges. So the government has absolutely no incentive to move forward. They just charge the accused with the minimum offenses, and that's all. And
they have the incentive of Article 10, right, to move forward. If they don't move forward, presumably the military judge, the lower court, this court, could find a violation of Article 10.
That's correct. But in this case, the government did not ask. Article 10 provides a due diligence standard in contrast to RCM, which is a flat rule, it's a time period, which in this case was clearly exceeded by the 126 days until the interview with the second witness, in fact. But Article 10 provides, Article 10, the government can proceed with due diligence and still violate RCM 707 if they don't move to proceed promptly to trial within 120 days. Now, the government certainly has an obligation to investigate. They need to investigate the charges, but what they don't have is an obligation to, or they don't have the right to perfect their case. They have a right to move forward and to investigate charges, but in this case, the government didn't do that. They waited until, again, 126 days after the confession to actually interview a known victim. So even by any standard, due diligence, we're looking at the time frame itself. The due diligence, again, Article 10 and RCM are separate but distinct and complementary provisions. What we are left with in this case, this is somewhat similar to what the Air Force or the Coast Guard experienced in United States v. Cooley, and that is, as that court took pains to say, the government took a pause as to add new specifications. It created intentional diversion to new activity, displaying a disregard for the speedy trial rights of the confined appellant. So the accused sits in confinement and languishes, and the right of speedy trial, if it's to have any teeth at all, this is the perfect case for it to be enforced. Again, the appellant confessed everything on one night. The government chose not to proceed until 126 days later to even interview a witness. This wasn't a witness they had to go out and find out what witnesses were in the universe. This is the specific witness that the appellant had said, yes, this is the woman that I distributed pornography to. So, again, this seems to be the Cooley instance where you have a government pausing and not diligently pursue it.
Well, if the accused was so eager to be tried, why did he object to joinder and kick the ball down the road another 2 months?
Your Honor, you're correct. The accused did object to joinder, but that is why he did that. It was a decision within his defense counsel's purview. And it's entirely possible that the trial defense counsel had reasons for doing it. But remember,
well, I'm sure he had reasons. But if he's languishing under oppressive pretrial confinement, and they're ready to try him, and he says, "No, don't try me. I object to joinder." Well, where does that leave us?
Well, sir, what it leaves is the defendant, the appellant, is in confinement. And remember, the appellant, things never get better for the government.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that last.
Sorry. The appellant is in confinement.
Yeah.
And he's under this oppressive situation where things don't get better for him under a pretrial agreement. So, yes, he did object to joinder, but we don't know why he objected, and that should not be held against him, particularly when you have an accused sitting in trial confinement for 364 days. The trial defense counsel, the second yes, the trial defense counsel's tactical decision, I can't do that on this record. But again, appellant was in confinement. The government let him sit there for 364 days. The speedy trial right in the military is extremely important because units must operate, individuals must deploy. So to say that the accused, there's, you know, even though the government violated the 120-day rule of 707, even though they had substantial information under the U.S. v. Johnson rule, to say that the government doesn't need to go forward, doesn't need to move quickly, shows that the speed would show that the speedy trial right has absolutely no teeth.
Well, it's got 707. Where you say, well, there's an ambiguity here.
Correct.
How is there an ambiguity?
The ambiguity is that RCM 707 does not address the scenario where an accused is already in confinement.
That's not an ambiguity. It doesn't address it. Therefore, it doesn't cover it. Therefore, the president promulgated the rule and chose not to cover it. That's not an ambiguity.
It certainly leaves open the question of what happens when an accused is in confinement.
Well, an article, the problem is you got 707, which has time standards and lays out, you know, a fairly elaborate rule.
Right.
And you've got Article 10, which says nothing. Except, thou shalt be fast.
So you have Article 10 in RCM 707,
right,
which set forth distinct and complementary rights. The government can still proceed with due diligently under Article 10,
mm-hmm,
and yet violate 707. So,
but that's not an ambiguity.
Your Honor, you're correct. It is a gap. Where you have this.
Well, that presumably the president intended it that way, or is there anything in the record that shows the president didn't intend it that way?
No, there's nothing in the record to indicate that. But again, the appellant would submit that such a reading makes no sense. The prosecution would have no incentive to promptly charge an accused with any offenses other than the minimum necessary. To show Robinson and Proctor as precedential cases makes no sense. Those cases involved different investigations, different charges. Why should the accused be prejudiced and this held to that Proctor standard when that is not this case? This case was the case where the government knew everything on that night of November 12th, and yet they waited. Johnson has never been overturned. Kosman overturned the 90-day presumption, but it did not overturn Johnson. Johnson is very clear on telling us when the government's burden of diligence begins. So in this case, again,
have we cited Johnson favorably for this proposition since Kosman?
No, but the lower courts have cited it.
I'm aware of that. Thank you.
So, again, there's a potential for government abuse in this case, Your Honor. After an accused is confined on one set of charges, the newly discovered misconduct is never subject to speedy trial until the preferral of charges. Johnson should be read in conjunction with 707. To find the substantial information rule still applies. Any other ruling would do what the Bray Court said, would emasculate speedy trial rights. So in order to protect and show the speedy trial has teeth and to protect the rights of accused who remains in confinement for 364 days, RCM should be
How much of that time was based on the defense request for continuance?
Roughly. There were two requests for continuance, roughly 14, 15 days. So the accused delay, if it were, does not override 364 days of pretrial confinement. And again, By the very terms of RCM 707, the government waited 126 days to interview a known witness. This doesn't seem to make sense to prejudice an appellant. Sir, if, Your Honor, if there are no further questions.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Morning, Chief Judge Erdman, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. I'm Lieutenant James Belforti, and along with Colonel Mark Jamison, I represent the United States in this matter. The issue put to the parties by this Court, whether the promulgation of RCM 707 abrogated the substantial information rule in Johnson, has already been answered by this Court in its action in Kossman. In Kossman, the Court expressly overturned the Burton and Driver rule, finding that the landscape of speedy trial had changed dramatically since the promulgation of RCM 707. That the president had acted responsibly in an area in which he had clear authority. Thus, the court rejected the, quote, rough-and-ready rule of thumb of Burton and Driver, and by extension, they also rejected the rule in Johnson.
But, Counsel, you're talking about by extension. So you're saying that we should infer from an instance where this court explicitly and affirmatively overruled two cases that this court didn't take the additional step to affirmatively overrule Johnson as well?
Yes, Your Honor, because it's, first of all, Kossman is not, it's overruling Burton and Driver, but they're also overruling a framework. The Burton Driver.
Why would we not have explicitly overruled Johnson if that was the intent of this court?
Because that wasn't the issue in the case, and the court's only going to rule on the narrowest issue it has to.
We didn't overrule Johnson if that wasn't the issue in the case.
Well, yes, Your Honor, I'm saying the court implicitly overruled it, and I would also point out the fact that Johnson hasn't been applied since Robinson or Kossman for the premise that the substantial information rule applies to either RCM 707 or Article 10.
It's been applied in the lower courts.
It's been applied, yes, it was applied by, well, let me correct that. It's been applied by the Army Court in 1988 in Baden. That was before Kossman. It was applied by the Air Force Court in Bray in 2000, but then it was repudiated in 2003 by Proctor. And the most recent instance of it being applied was in Cooley. So, and we have large spans of time in between those periods of time.
But
so,
basically, doesn't the substantial information rule say when the Article 10 speedy trial clock will start in certain circumstances? And the fact that Burton has been overruled and we no longer have the 3-month or 90-day rule, we still, in those certain circumstances where an individual is in pretrial confinement and they bring later additional charges, we still have to determine how we determine when the speedy trial clock starts for those additional charges.
I would say if that's the case, Your Honor, then for Article 10, and it would probably go to the first Barker factor, which is at what point do we start to calculate the delay and whether or not that delay is facially unreasonable to trigger a full Barker analysis. But it's never been applied in the RCM 707 context. And in Robinson, we actually had a situation in which an appellant was being investigated for charges. They had a statement from him about marijuana charges in March. He'd been implicated in those charges earlier. Then he's restrained for another offense unrelated in April. Then they preferred those marijuana charges in June, and this court found that was when the clock started, was in June. So that was a time in which this court had the opportunity to reconcile the substantial information rule of Johnson with RCM 707 because they both existed contemporaneously, and the court declined to do that. And furthermore, the court endorsed the Army Court's refusal to apply the pre-1984 RCM precedent of this court before the promulgation of RCM 707.
Counsel, this is a little outside the granted issue, and so I understand the government may not be prepared to comment on it. But the CCA in this circumstance, in this case, said that where an individual is in pretrial confinement and additional charges are brought, Article 10 isn't even in the picture. It doesn't apply, period. Is that the position of the government? And I realize it's not part of the grand issue. So
No, I don't want to speak completely extemporaneous with you. Would you mind if I had a minute to consult with co-counsel?
Please.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. And like I said, as you pointed out, I haven't briefed the issue, but what I would say is that Article 10 does apply and can apply in that situation because it provides a backstop to RCM 707. So the basis of a lot of appellant's argument is, you know, this hypothetical of horrors, which is, oh, the government could just drag its feet and do all these terrible things. But that's not the case because we have Article 10 and we have the Sixth Amendment. So what the appellant is saying is, there will be a situation in which the government intentionally and maliciously does not prefer charge. They prefer the minimum charges, and then they wait a really long time, and then they prefer additional charges. But if that were the case, then you simply make an Article 10 motion, and you say the second factor of Barker, the reasons for the delay, malicious dragging of the feet, that's probably not going to cut muster under Barker analysis. So they can exist together, Your Honor. And that is kind of why RCM 707, it doesn't make sense to try to fit the, you know, square peg of Johnson into the round hole of RCM 707 because, as you pointed out yourself, Judge Suki, that RCM 707 doesn't address that issue, and that's probably the President saying, well, I'm leaving that issue unaddressed so that Article 10 can address it because it exists, and the Sixth Amendment can address it because that exists as well.
Does the administrative history of the promulgation of 707 contain any indication of an intention to occupy the field? In other words, Joint Service Committee, the executive order, da-da-da-da-da-da.
I don't.
Is there any expression of an intention to occupy the field by the promulgation of this rule?
Your Honor, I can't point you to anything specifically. All I would say is that, as the court pointed out in Kossman, you know, it was the President's, acting responsibly in an area in which he had clear authority. So though there isn't for lack of a better term, a legislative history or something that says, I intend to make this my sole purview, I'd say from the plain text of RCM 707 and from this court's ruling in Kossman, that is certainly inferable. So as the appellant I wanted to point back to one thing. That the appellant referred to the burden of diligence starting with substantial information under RCM 707. And that kind of illustrates the incongruity of the argument because diligence, reasonable diligence, is the Article 10 standard. It's different than RCM 707, and it's something that this Court has recognized numerous times. So that's the core of the argument. You can't have it both ways. You can't say, well, you know, this is a situation where the government didn't exercise due diligence under RCM 707 and they waited all this time and that's a violation of RCM 707. And never mind that the plain text doesn't say it's a violation. We have to read that in because otherwise it'll emasculate speedy trial rights. That's just not the case because that's why Article 10 exists. And that's the word choice is important because it shows the real argument here is, well, the government didn't act with reasonable diligence. But we're not talking about Article 10. We're talking about RCM 707 right now. And when
do you agree with the CCA that date for purposes of RCM 707 for the additional charges is the date of the respective referrals?
Yes, Your Honor. That's the United States' position. And as the appellant concedes, we're left with the plain text of RCM 707. As the appellant concedes, if read plainly, the United States prevails in the matter. The only reason to depart from it, the plain text, is if it creates an absurdity. And as I was arguing before, it doesn't create an absurdity because there are backstops and prophylactics to the kinds of abuses that the appellant has brought up before.
Well, isn't part of the baggage that Article 10 drags in Johnson, since it's an interpretive rule of Article 10, or what is it? What's its relation to Article 10?
I would say that Johnson is the answer to a question. Johnson kind of illustrates what can happen when we have judge-made systems of clocks like this. Because we have Burton Driver, which says, okay, 90 days sounds reasonable to us. what do we do if, you know, we have separate charges and they come at different times? And then Johnson answers that question. So it's kind of, you know, ad hoc rulemaking as we go. But that's Johnson specifically answers the question, when do we start the Burton driver clock?
And if we abrogate Johnson, then nothing specifically answers the question.
No, Your Honor, I think RCM 707 could be a guidepost for that, but it could answer that question. It could be used for that reason, but it's the United States' position that because Kossmann did away with the framework and because Johnson hasn't been applied to Article 10 in the last 20 years. I mean, we've had numerous Article 10 issues, but we haven't had an issue where we said, okay, Johnson still exists within this Article 10 context in order to answer this question. When does the first factor under Barker, when do we start to calculate the delay and whether or not that is facially unreasonable? And in this case, for example, if we use Johnson in the Article 10 context, it doesn't really change anything because the lower court still did a full Barker analysis. They found the delay, even calculating it at the amount that they did, 115 days, they still said, well, that's enough to trigger the full Barker analysis. So the appellant got the benefit of the full Barker analysis and was able to advocate that this wasn't reasonably diligent and that he'd been prejudiced and all the other factors of Barker. So here we don't see a difference. Your Honors, if there are no further questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you. Rebuttal?
Article 10 and RCM 707 clearly are distinct but complementary provisions. And although the government has said Article 10 is a backstop, in fact, it isn't. And in the Wilder case itself, the court said Article 10 doesn't apply to the charges that appellant was not confined on. So this is the very circumstance, this is the very issue, the gap that RCM that needs to be addressed. The fact that the appellant can be charged with additional misconduct, or the appellant can, the Article 10 would never apply, even though there's additional misconduct. So that's why the RCM 707 rule of 120 days is so critical. It may operate in situations where Article 10 does not operate, and at least that is what the Wilder court said. One other point, Your Honor, in relation to U.S. v. Bray and U.S. v. Proctor. Again, the Bray and Proctor cases are entirely different. Bray is the situation that we're dealing with in this instance, where it was one instance of misconduct. It wasn't separate investigations, separate misconduct. Bray, again, it was the inextricably intertwined cases where the additional charges were inextricably intertwined with the original charges. And that's all I have, sir, if there are further questions.
Thank you, counsel. The case is now submitted. The clerk will stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.